Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Blog Talk family. This is Leslie Gist, and this is a special show we have tonight. We have on Jean Libby. She's an author of a few books, and she started her research in 1979. But our primary guest at this hour is Miss Brenda Pitts. She is a descendant of John Copeland. John Copeland was one of the members of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Hello, Brenda. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
How are you?
This is a great night. We're here talking about John Brown's raid. Can you tell the audience the significance of John Brown's raid and why we're discussing it tonight instead of another time? It's a special occasion that you will be attending this week. Next weekend.
You'd like for me to do that, Leslie?
Yes, yes.
Okay, this coming weekend, the 16th through the 18th, there will be the commemoration, the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. And on that weekend, about 55 Copeland descendants and Leary descendants will be attending the festivities to remember the sacrifice that our ancestors made.
Okay, and what is the sacrifice your ancestor, John Copeland, made?
John Copeland was actually survived the raid and was captured, tried in Charlestown, and hung on December the 16th, 1859, because of his participation. And Lewis Leary, whose sisters were married to John's uncles, was also there, and he was from Oberlin, Ohio, and he was killed during the battle.
Okay. Now, was John Copeland from Oberlin, Ohio?
Yes.
Okay. Now, we spoke in our last show about the significance of Oberlin and Ohio. I know we have Miss Libby on the phone, and you could come anytime you want, but just recap the history of Ohio and why these men came from Ohio?
Well, as Jean said in the previous interview, Ohio tended to be, people who went to Ohio were ones who were more outward in terms of their feelings about the abolitionist movement, and they believed more strongly in ending it. And I forget the term that you used, Jean, to describe them.
I guess, I don't know, it just, and abolitionists, but militant, certainly militant.
They were defending the Northwest Territory, Yes,
and Overland was founded basically by a church and with a religious orientation. And it tended then to be established by people who were very militant in their thinking. And they were militant to the, because they believed that they had to walk the talk. So when the college was established, which the college and the town were established at the same time, the college believed, and it was an early requirement, that you actually had to do service as part of your college curriculum. So a lot of the students from Oberlin were involved in the Underground Railroad and in the abolitionist movement. And
now, this college was integrated, wasn't it?
Yes, it was integrated.
And what year was it established around, roughly?
It was established 175 years ago.
Okay. And you and I had a conversation about HBCUs. Would you consider Oberlin a traditional HBCU?
No, Oberlin was not an HBCU. Oberlin College was actually started as a white college. And then early in its history, it was the first college to allow blacks to attend, and I believe one of the first ones to allow women.
Okay.
So it was very progressive in its
thinking.
And
this is where your family was, this is where the Copelands
yes.
lived.
The Copeland, five of the six Copeland children attended Oberlin College.
Awesome. So now we have the setting of your family's background and their sentiments and where they came from. Now, did you have any relatives that was involved in the raid that were religious or ministers? Because you mentioned the school was founded by a church, and so was the town. Was there a strong feeling that you got that your family was deeply rooted in religion, Christianity?
Yes, in fact, John Copeland's father was a minister. And if you read some of the writings of his uncles, they were deeply religious people. And as I said earlier, they believed in walking the talk. Now, the family came from North Carolina, from Raleigh, North Carolina. John's father was actually the slave master who freed him when he died in, like, 1812.
And that was his slave name, Copeland?
We're not really sure. I haven't been able to pinpoint exactly what his name was. So then John was what they would refer to as an artisan, my grandfather John. And he was a carpenter and, in fact, helped to build the State House in Raleigh, North Carolina. And after a while, during the 1840s, with a lot of what they referred to as the black laws that were passed to restrict the rights of freed blacks in the South, it became to the point where with his large family, they just couldn't survive. So in 1843, they went by wagon to Oberlin, Ohio. They were originally headed for Indiana and met someone from Oberlin who said, you should go there. So my grandfather left, or my great-great-great-grandfather left his family in Indiana and with a friend went to Oberlin, Ohio. When he arrived there, it was a Sunday, and his thought was, this was God's country, because what he observed was a black man and a white man walking down the street, actively engaged in a conversation as peers. And so he fell in love with the place and went and got his family.
That had to be a culture shock for him coming out of North Carolina.
It was.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe, from my perspective, Oberlin was truly one of the few places that I would refer to as the promised land, because it was a community where blacks had the opportunity to make a living, could live where they wanted to live, and were treated with dignity and respect. And that didn't exist in many parts of the North. You could move to the North. I live in Indiana, but Indiana was always had a very segregated past, and the rights of blacks in Indiana were very, very restricted. So they appreciated the town of Oberlin. And in one of the writings from my family, it said that they loved Oberlin and Oberlin loved them. So later in the 50s, I believe it was around 55, two of John's mother's brothers, Henry and Wilson Bruce Evans, moved from North Carolina to Oberlin and settled as well. And they married two of Lewis Leary's sisters. And that's why there's confusion around Lewis Leary being John Copeland's uncle. But as it was only through marriage, and when you look at it, Lewis Leary didn't even move to Oberlin until a couple years before the raid.
Now, I think while I was listening to you ladies talk about Ohio and Oberlin, I think I've gotten a connection as to why a lot of militants moved to Ohio. Ohio was one of the places that a lot of revolutionary soldiers received land grants, in exchange for money because they didn't have money after the Revolutionary War. So they decided to give the soldiers land in the Northwest Territory. And many of these soldiers, instead of accepting the land as payment, they donated the land to free slaves. And I think that military connection may have had a root within the settlers that moved to Ohio. Have any of you come across anything related to that point I'm trying to make? As far
I haven't.
I think that's a very good one. John Brown's grandfather was a soldier in the American Revolution, and I think you'll find that in these early immigrants, they came in 1805, that there'll be a lot of people who are, who have fathers in the or themselves looking for this land, settling on it. This also happens in Pennsylvania, and that's one of the things that why John Brown moves there is in 1825. There's land opened up for people who have been in the American Revolution or their descendants, and all they have to do is improve the land. So, but for setting it aside for African Americans, I don't see anyone doing that except for Gerrit Smith in New York.
Now, is Gerrit black or white?
He's white.
Oh, okay.
He's really rich. He is, the Henry Hudson, the Hudson's Bay Company?
Mm-hmm.
He's in business with him.
Like the Henry Hudson Bridge in New York City?
Yeah.
Now, I was going there. That is so funny because you heard of the Kosciuszko Bridge, I can't pronounce it.
No, not that one.
He was one of the people who fought in the Revolutionary War. I think he's from Poland. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he was paid by the government in land, and he wrote a letter to Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin. He wrote a letter to Benjamin Franklin telling him he wanted him to be the liaison to settle some free African Americans in Ohio. So when you ladies were talking, I was trying to figure out, well, why would these militant type people, because I was under the impression that the pacifists, the very religious people, were moving to Ohio. Until tonight, listening to you, and trying to figure out how did this happen, and now I'm starting to connect the dots. So it makes sense now that you said John Brown was claiming land from his ancestors who had earned the land through the war.
Yes, but there's something else that he does in Massachusetts and in New York is that there's laws. In fact, these laws start getting passed in Ohio as well, and I'm sure you're familiar with them in Indiana, Brenda. is that black people can't buy land.
Right.
And this gets passed pretty quickly in Ohio because it's not only the militant abolitionists who move there, a whole lot of people move there.
Yes.
And so these black laws, one of his first acts is to oppose them. And he also helps people in Massachusetts when he's living there in getting property. He helps people in the African American community by taking them down to the land office or the courthouse or wherever you have to go, signing the papers for them as guarantors, you know, as a guarantor. And because he firmly believes that it's the value of owning your own property that is going to make people citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find that in your family history to be the case that your family started acquiring land? Go ahead.
In fact, Delilah Copeland, who was John, Delilah Evans Copeland was John's mother, and her brothers were also successful businessmen, and they both owned property, as did the Copeland family.
And what year was this around?
This would have been in the 1840s and 50s.
In Ohio?
In Ohio.
Okay.
In Oberlin, Ohio. And I believe Oberlin, the point that Jean made is a valid one. Oberlin was distinct from the rest of Ohio. Not everyone in Ohio felt like the people in Oberlin did. So I think it was a bit unusual. I would also note that John Brown's father, I believe, was a trustee of Oberlin College and lived not that far from Oberlin. So there was John Brown and his family were very familiar with Oberlin and the people of Oberlin, and there was probably a lot of interaction.
Now, is there a school in Harpers Ferry? I thought that John Brown's family was connected to a school.
There was. It's a school that was founded right at the end of the Civil War, or actually during the Civil War, for freedmen. And
Storer College.
Yeah, Storer College.
Yes.
And it was founded for people who were freed from slavery. It was first a camp. It's on top of a place called Camp Hill, of people who were freed from slavery during the Civil War, and the Union Army would protect them. And so the school that was founded there was Storer College, and it was known as the college associated with John Brown, although of course he was not personally associated because he was hanged in 1859. But everyone thinks of Harper's Ferry, they think of John Brown, and then there's Storer College. But it closed in the 1950s, and that's a sad story.
Was that an integrated school?
No, it was not. And the reason that it closed is when integration came, mm-hmm. the West Virginia authorities decided that they would close many of the predominantly black institutions and integrate the white ones. So Shepherd College, which is nearby, became an integrated college.
Reluctantly.
Yeah, and then the black college would be closed. And, of course, who lost their jobs?
The African Americans. We have that story right here in New Jersey, a school called Bordentown School, campus, 300 acres. So that was a pattern that was going around in the 1950s.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. And now the land of the school is part of the Park Service. So what they've done is really good. They have the archives of the school and the history of it, and they have put that into a museum and into displays so that people can get the history of the school and the people, the African Americans who lived in the area, because of course that will be the denominator. That will be what it's the schools that bring people together. In you know after the Civil War, that's what happens, and so so the Park Service has done that. But when you come to Harper's Ferry next weekend and there are events occurring at what they call the Mather Institute, these are the old buildings of the school.
I'm looking forward to going. I am. Now, Brenda, how did your family use education as a means of, excelling? Because your family seems like they were very successful, owning a lot of land and businesses in 1840 in Ohio. What role did education play?
Well, education was viewed by most blacks of the time as the way that you took advantage of your freedom, because you needed to know how to read and write and do math and those types of things in order to be a full citizen. So that's why it was the ticket to get ahead, and that's why it was important. But it was important not just for them. It was important as a way for them to help others, because the whole thing that the Evans and Copeland families both were about was not in their family or personal success. It was about helping others.
That was just a consequence of being a person with morals and being helpful. The success.
Yes, and I think that's why they were attracted to Oberlin, because they believed that their whole task was to reach back and help others, because they couldn't truly be free unless everyone was free.
Now,
and when you look even at Lewis Leary's father, who was a freed person living in North Carolina, his father actually owned a business there, a harness-making business, and used that business as a way of helping slaves to buy their freedom.
I have about three questions for you.
And you can imagine even what he dealt with being a black abolitionist in North Carolina.
Now, I have three questions for you. One is about the you said one of your relatives was a minister?
My great-great-great-grandfather.
Now, when we look at the ministers of today and the role that they're playing, especially what had happened during President Obama's campaign, how can you describe, or will you describe, the role of the ministers of today to those other ministers, like your ancestors, in a role they played with the Underground Railroad?
Well, many of the people, my grandfather did it as a side business. He was not a full-time minister. And a lot of blacks at the time also had to have a job to feed their families. So
they didn't rely on tithing.
No, he didn't rely on that. But a lot of the ministers at that time devoted themselves to this whole abolitionist movement and were actively involved. In fact, my great-great-great-grandfather worked with John Mercer Langston, who was spent much of his adult life in Oberlin. And
who is Mr. Langston?
Actually part of a freedom movement there that was devoted to training blacks to be able to take care of themselves if they were ever attacked.
Now, you mentioned Langston. Could you just tell the audience who Charles Langston is?
Well, Charles Langston, who was John Mercer Langston's brother, was the grandfather to Langston Hughes. And Charles Langston married Lewis Leary's widow, Mary Sampson.
And what was his role in history?
Charles Langston?
Yes.
Charles Langston was one of the men who went to Oberlin, was part of the Oberlin-Wellington Rescue that Jean referred to earlier. And this was an action that where it was a combination of townspeople from all walks of life that came together to save this freedom seeker who was being tricked back into slavery. So as a result of their effort, there were about, I believe it was 37 men, predominantly those from Oberlin, who were arrested. Now, John Copeland, there was an arrest warrant out for him, but he was never arrested. And I believe that happened because he was the one who took John Price to Chatham, Canada, and he was there when they were looking for people. Louis Leary was the other one who was actively involved in the Oberlin-Wellington rescue. My Uncle John, together with his uncles, were the ones who actually broke John Price out of the hotel room where the slave catchers were holding him. And so they took him back to Oberlin. Charles Langston was the first one that was tried for this offense and spoke very eloquently about why it was important that slavery be ended. Of course, he was found guilty of the charges and fined heavily. But later on, they ended up, the government couldn't, the people of Oberlin found a way of indicting the slave catchers. So they basically ended up forcing the government's hand because the Oberlin people were basically jailed because President Buchanan wanted to show Oberlin that they couldn't step up against his laws, and he was one of the ones involved with supporting the Fugitive Slave Act. So he wanted to show his support for the South and try to put Oberlin in its place. And that
the little Oberlin, little city, little town of Oberlin,
yes,
was being, they were trying to crush this town by the president.
Yes.
Wow.
But, again, as I said earlier, the Oberlin people ended up indicting the slave catchers. So then the president had to cut a deal because the Oberlin people wouldn't leave jail. And so there was a lot of publicity. We talked earlier, Jean talked about the role of publicity in the abolitionist movement. So there was a lot of publicity about the Oberlin-Wellington rescue, and in fact, it's viewed as one of several incidents that led to the beginning of the Civil War.
Now, was this before the Fugitive Slave Law, or was it after a slave
act? This was after. This would have been 1858,
okay,
so it happened a year before Harper's Ferry.
Okay, so there was a succession of incidents that led to the Civil War.
Yes, and I really like the point that Jean made earlier about the Civil War really started in Kansas, because
mm-hmm.
I believe that that's true. It officially started in Fort Sumner, but it actually started much earlier than that.
I second that emotion as well.
And the other point I would like to make would be that the significance of John Brown was that up until this time, the slave owners never had to take the abolitionists seriously because they knew that they were more about talking. They thought through their making a good argument. They could persuade the country to abolish slavery. So they didn't have any fear. And Kansas, a lot of people talk about John Brown being so violent, but violence existed in Kansas before John Brown got there.
Violence existed with the first slave that was enslaved in America, you know. So violence it's been violence throughout the whole system. I think that we only call it violence when it's in opposition to slavery. I think that's kind of strange.
And I think it's also important, Leslie, that we remember that Harper's Ferry was only the first part of John Brown's plan. The second part of his plan was to establish these small bands of people who would live in the mountains and would go out and raid the plantations and free slaves. Some of these slaves would be sent on the Underground Railroad north. Others would join in the overall freedom movement. And his hope was to be able to move this southward and to basically use this as a way of forcing the South's hand and to make them end slavery. Would you agree, Jean?
Oh, yes.
When you said he was trying to set people up in the woods and the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I see a pattern developing in this conversation we're having. It seems as though that John Brown's family and the Copeland family, they strategically moved and settled in different places, and not all of them settled in the same town. You said North Carolina, Indiana, Ohio. John Brown had relatives and people all over the country as well. Do you ladies see a pattern developing? Like, am I the only one that see something going on there? Because we said that it seems like their network was so tight, it was much better than Facebook or YouTube that we're dealing with today. And I think it has something to do with the large family and how I think they strategically lived in these different parts of the country and was able to keep in contact with one another. She mentioned a steamboat. Jean Libby mentioned a steamboat and all this high-tech, these high-tech technology being used for the purpose of sending messages.
Mm-hmm. Well, people certainly move in groups. I mean, families move in groups, and they often go where others are before, but deliberate movement was Kansas. And then there's also the deliberate movement after the Civil War of the black towns, which are in Kansas, many of them. And
did you clear that up?
Yeah. Brenda, talk about that a little bit. You can do that better than I can much.
About the black towns?
About the black towns, how African Americans are moving together after the Civil War, after freedom,
to form
communities.
They moved that way before freedom because my mother's family is also from North Carolina. And Indiana has, I believe it's maybe 20, 25 black communities that were established during the 40s and 50s. And I believe that the reason that they were established, people would move with their family and friends, and that's the way the Copelands moved to Ohio, was with their family and friends, and they had to move in bands because of the danger that was involved. Mm-hmm. Because you can imagine that at any point in time, you're going through Southern Territory, and you could be stopped by these bounty hunters who could just, they didn't care if you were free or not, they could kidnap you or kidnap your children and sell you into slavery. So this was a very, very dangerous thing that they did. When they got to the North, I talked about Indiana's history. When the North, in order to protect their freedom, they tended then to establish these small communities so that they could protect themselves. In Indiana, the schools were segregated. Blacks had no freedoms. They could not vote, bear arms, go to separate schools. It was just a little bit different than the South, but the rights were really severely restricted. So that's what with my mother's family and both with my father's family, they were basically, the families came here and located in these small black settlements. They tended to be located near the Underground Railroad routes. And
your family moved to Indiana prior to the Civil War and lived during the Underground Railroad?
My family has been in Indiana for over 150 years.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
And
okay.
They came from North Carolina. And they moved to, there's a little place called Madison, Indiana, that's on the Ohio River. And it had the largest black population in Indiana after Indianapolis. And they were a very active Underground Railroad station. And in fact, I'm sure, Jean, you've heard of George DuBaptiste.
Yeah.
Or George Baptiste.
Yes.
He actually lived in Madison and had to move because it was getting too hot for him. They had identified him and were getting ready to arrest him. So that's when he went to Detroit, where he helped, I believe it was thousands of freedom seekers to freedom in Canada. So that was why these black settlements started. And then after the Civil War in Kansas, they continued because that way they were able to have their own government. They were, again, able to be safe because not after the Civil War, then you had the KKK coming into play. And so they had to protect themselves by staying together.
Well, that's awesome. Now, I heard of a town called Princeton, Indiana.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Princeton?
It was one of, Princeton had a black settlement as well. And that's where John Copeland's sister, moved to Princeton, Indiana.
Two questions. Now, you said your family settled on the Underground Railroad route.
Yes.
Do you think that was a strategy that you had some in Indiana on the Underground Railroad routes and some in Oberlin, and that they communicated? And the second part of the question is, have you ever heard of the Quilts? And do you know if that's fact or fiction?
Well, the first part of the question, they deliberately did settle near the Underground Railroad routes because that's where there tended to be people who were favorable to blacks and the freedom cause, and they felt that they would be safer there. That's Richmond, Indiana, which is where John Copeland, Grandpa John, was headed, was one of those Underground Railroad stops, and had a very active abolitionist background. And when he went to Oberlin, that's what he was looking for. Will my family, first of all, be safe here? And second, will I be able to make a living and support my family? And third, will I be treated as a full citizen? And that means have a right to do any job I want and to be educated and be able to vote and to participate fully in what's going on in my neighborhood. And that's why they went to Oberlin. On the second part, when you're talking about the quilts, I believe I've never seen a quilt that was done, but I do believe in the story and believe that it was real.
I believe in the quilt, too.
Okay, well, I'm happy to hear you talk about the quilts and how active your African-American family was during the Underground Railroad, and they consciously settled for the purpose of helping others and rescuing them through slavery. I think that is commendable, and so much more should be said to you for teaching us, you know, about your family legacy. And, I mean, you are really imparting some wisdom, the both of you. Jean Libby, you are too.
I have a question for Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, during the Civil War, John Copeland's brother joined the first African-American soldiers before there was the United States Colored Troops. He joined a group in Kansas, and he was an artillery officer.
Yes.
In the 1st Kansas Colored Regiment.
Do
you have information about him?
Yes. Henry Copeland, who would have been, he was close to his brother and would have been the oldest son left after John was executed. moved out to, when the Civil War started, he went out to Kansas with John Brown Jr. And while there, there was John Brown Jr. was trying to get a troop together, and I think he did get one, but they wouldn't allow my uncle to be in it because of his race. So then John Brown Jr., I believe, hooked him up with Susan B. Anthony's brother, who was working with this first colored troop out there. And they had made him a second lieutenant, I believe it was. And he, again, when the government went to formally accept that unit, they would not allow my uncle to be a commissioned officer. So he resigned because he said there was no way that he was going to not be able to do what was he should be able to do. And then later there was, after that, there was a troop formed in Fort Leavenworth by Ford, and it was a light artillery, Douglas light artillery.
Yeah.
And it was the only colored troop that was led by black people, and he was a commissioned officer in that particular troop.
Oh, my.
And they were the ones, when you read the history, this particular troop was credited with stopping the movement of the South because the South thought if they could take the West, and Fort Leavenworth was the last fort on the western side, that then they could come at the North through that way and win the war. So they held off the South that stopped them and were able then to help the North win the Civil War. And then the family ended up settling in Lawrence, Kansas.
That's
where he's buried, and his family was there for quite a number of years.
Now, we're down to our last 2 minutes.
Okay.
Before you give us your information, your contact information, I have one last question for both of you. What was Lincoln's role and relationship and his sentiments and vice versa? What was John Brown's sentiments towards Lincoln?
Can't do that in 2 minutes.
Oh, well, no, we're going to be streaming in 2 minutes. But we'll be on, this tape is going to keep running. They're not going to cut us off. You can use as much time that you like.
You want to handle that one, John?
Okay, before you answer that question, let's get your information in because we will need that in within the next minute.
Well, I did that already, so Brenda does that. No.
Okay. I'm Brenda Pitts, and I'm the grand-grand-grandniece of John Anthony Copeland. And I have been studying the Copeland family history for the last 10 years now and will be writing a book next year about the family and their contributions because the story goes beyond John Anthony Copeland to the Copeland and the Evans family and the contributions that they made. And the family was all about social justice, which is the legacy that they left to all of us. And I'd like the world to know about how blacks have been normal citizens throughout their time here, making contributions to society from the very early days. And I don't know, Jean, if you were aware that Lillian...
The name of your book? Do you have a name of a title for your book
yet? Not yet.
And no contact information, no website?
No.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
I don't know, Jean, if you're aware that Lillian Ivanti was related to John Copeland. Do you know who Lillian Ivanti is?
No.
She was one of the first black opera singers and sang for Eleanor Roosevelt in the White House. So she was related to him through Henry Evans. And then his cousin started the kindergarten program in Washington, D.C. So this is a family that was really, really active in the educational movement. Another cousin moved with Thomas Sewell in Borden to North Carolina and opened up several small black schools to train the newly freed slaves so that they would be able to make a living.
Oh, my. You've got
okay.
a book there.
I know we had mentioned your relatives not being able to serve in the Civil War, and I was wondering, what did you find anything in writing from your relatives about how they felt not being able to participate in the Civil War, and what were their opinions about Lincoln?
They never expressed. I don't have anything in writing.
Uh-huh.
I found out the family story through my grandmother,
okay.
And my grandmother used to gather all of her grandchildren together and tell us the story of Oberlin College, the Copeland family, John Copeland, and John Brown. And then she would take us outside, and we would get into a circle, and we would sing John Brown's Bidey.
Oh.
And that was her way of imprinting us in us that this was a legacy of social justice and helping others. And then later I remembered the story when I became an adult and later started to research it.
What song was it that you were singing in the circle?
John Brown's Bidey. You know, John Brown's Bidey Lies a Motoring.
No, I never heard of it. I have to look on YouTube when the show is over to see
well,
if I can.
It was the
you won't find it on
of
YouTube.
The Civil War soldiers.
Oh, okay.
So it's a popular song. So she was, I say that because John Brown was an important figure in our family's life. The family was very proud. When I found the obituary for Henry Copeland, the one I referred to that was in Kansas, his last dying words were around John Brown and the fact that John Brown did so much for the cause of freedom. So I know now there's some people who have a mixed view of this whole situation, but to my family, they were always very proud of what John Brown did, and they were very proud of Uncle John's contribution to that cause.
How do you feel about the descendants of John Brown? I interviewed Alice yesterday, and her family, you know, really doesn't talk about John Brown, his legacy. How do you, you know, how do you feel about her family? What would you tell the relatives who are not proud of John Brown if you could sit down with them, you know?
That's a good question. I would urge them to really study the man and who he was, what he stood for, and why understand why he did what he did. And I admire him because I do believe he was one of those few men that comes along in the world who makes a difference with no regard for his own personal
welfare. Safety.
And you know, we talk in the Bible, you know, there's a verse in the Bible about giving your life up for your fellow man, and he felt strongly enough. And I wish there were more people today that would be willing to stand up and take whatever action they deem necessary for the rights of others. Because when you look at it today, there's still a lot of social issues that need to be addressed. And we sometimes become complacent. So I would urge them to really be proud and to try to accept their legacy and build upon it.
Do you think that they're not proud of it because of what the media, you know, the negative backlash that, you know, his legacy has suffered, and she mentioned, Alice mentioned that one of her relatives in the 40s, a woman, sued Warner Brothers for defamation of character for their portrayal of him in one of their movies. So I don't
I read that.
Oh, you read that? Okay. I was hoping you would have said you listened to my show. But
I did.
You get the kudos. You get the gold star.
Yeah.
She's all going right. In timeout.
When I met Allison and her brother, they were in high school, and my children were in the same high school at the same time, and I used to bring in my slideshow for the teacher, and about John Brown, and what they told me Alice and Jim, was that they were concerned because he was always referred to as a crazy man. And no one, especially a teenager, wants to be associated. I mean, the textbooks say he was insane, categorically. And so this is the issue here. No one is willingly associated with someone who is considered insane. And when the family doesn't talk about it, you just may think it's true.
Right.
Right. Well,
and
I'm
our
glad
family.
That you're talking about it, Miss John Copeland's, you know, your name, but I know that I like to call you Miss John Copeland because that's what I, you know, usually refer to you, Brenda. But I'm so happy that you're sharing it, not just with your family, but it's so important to us, you know, people in North Jersey like myself. To learn the truth, because we just, you know, our education is limited to Lincoln, Harriet. Sometimes we may hear about John Brown. So when we hear about the whole story and we get these stories that are in depth, it puts things in perspective and it makes us feel as though that ordinary people are just as important
yes.
as the people that get all the glory and the fame.
Ordinary, it's what the president has talked about with ordinary people can make extraordinary differences. And I believe that's what happened during the Civil Rights Movement. It's happened throughout our history. And I would like to see it happen again with people coming together from all walks of life to address some of the serious issues we have in our society today.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, the two of you, Jean Libby, Miss Brenda Pitts, talking about John Brown and John Copeland. You can visit their websites. Libby, what is your website?
It's AlliesForFreedom, all the one word, .org.
And Miss Brenda Pitts, tell us about your upcoming book.
My book will be the history of the Copeland Evans family and how ordinary people can make extraordinary impacts on the lives of others by being willing to give of themselves to others.
Okay. Well, it's been a wonderful time talking to you tonight. I'm looking forward to meeting both of you at the Harper's Ferry commemoration 150th. Do you want to explain this event before we say goodnight?
Well, I'd just like to thank you very much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, too.
And I'd like to thank you as well, Leslie. You're doing a great job.
Well,
even
I'm
if you
so
put
thankful.
Me in timeout.
Oh, yeah, I did. I had to put you in timeout. But I will meet you two ladies in person, God willing, and keep up the great work, and I can't wait to get your autographs next weekend.
Well, Jean, I hope to see you. I know I'll run into Leslie.
Yes. Now, are you with the group from Oberlin who are touring with Evelyn Taylor?
No.
Okay,
no, I've organized. The Copelands are having a family reunion, and one of my cousins is actually a descendant of the Copelands and the Evans Learys. So she will be there as well. So I have about 55 to 60 relatives and friends gathering, and we'll be doing, we have a whole itinerary set out for ourselves.
Yes. Will you be at the Descendants Walk on Sunday morning?
Yes.
All right, I'll be there too.
Great, great. I look forward to meeting you. And I've met Alice a couple of times now, and she's a fascinating person.
Yes, oh, likewise. We will have a great time.
Okay. I look forward to meeting both of you. And Leslie, we'll talk when you get to Harper's Ferry on Friday or Saturday.
Yes, I'll be there Saturday, but I'll call you Friday.
Okay, you have my cell phone number?
Yes, I'll give you a call Friday to let you know where I am.
Okay.
But I'll definitely be here Saturday.
Okay, great.
All right, and I'll give you a call too. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.